This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This August marks the 52nd anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. My guest, Major General Charles Sweeney, was the only pilot who flew on both missions. Now, in his late 70s, he offers his eyewitness account in his new book, War's End. General Sweeney commanded the Nagasaki mission, flying the plane that dropped the 10,000-pound plutonium bomb. 3 days before that, he piloted the plane that flew alongside the Enola Gay, the plane that bombed Hiroshima. At the moment the bomb was dropped, General Sweeney's plane released scientific instruments that measured the heat, blast, and radiation. Sweeney's plane also carried a team of scientists to read the measurements. In order to escape the blast, General Sweeney had to make a sharp turn and fly 8 miles in the 43-second interval between the bomb's release and detonation. He didn't know what to expect.
But just as we leveled out, I saw this tremendous flash, a flash that I guess human beings who weren't there have never seen, and I hope never see again. It was just a bright, bright flash in a fraction of a second, just obliterated the whole sky. The sky was a beautiful blue, as you know it is when you fly an airliner. It's up there without any contamination, a beautiful blue sky, and it turned into a white for a fraction of a second. That was the flash. And we kept going, and very shortly thereafter, the airplane was whacked by these concentric rings. We now know, we didn't know what they were when they were coming up, but they were concentric rings of clear, hot air, a phenomenon that man had never seen before. And they whacked the bottom of the airplane, and my bombardier, who had been was a very experienced man from European campaigns and had been shot down, actually, in Europe by anti-aircraft fire, turned to me with panic on his face and said, "Flak." Well, that meant we'd been hit, he thought. But the airplane was flying beautifully. So I, you know, it's as if you might think you had a flat tire and all of a sudden it's flat, your car is driving well, so you know you don't have a flat tire.
Now, what were you doing? What was your plan to get the plane away from the bomb as soon as the bomb was dropped so that you wouldn't be vaporized by the bomb?
Oh, to turn, to make a turn as quickly as we could, in the highest degree of bank that we could, at the speed we were going, and not that there's a restriction there, but to turn as quickly as we could to get out to a tangent to a semicircle, which mathematically puts you as far away from the point of explosion that you can get.
When did you find out what the damage really was to Hiroshima?
Oh, not for several days, but until a survey was made, we didn't know exactly what the damage was. A half mile from point zero, or a mile and a half, or a mile, or 2 miles, or whatever. However, I would say that after we were out of danger, so to speak, we made a turn to the right, in this case, to get heading in a southeasterly direction to A, get off the mainland of Japan and get out to sea, and B, head for our home base on the island of Tinian. When we made that turn, we looked over the city, which would be off of our right wing. We had a camera plane with us also. And we saw the city covered with a pall of black, gray-brown smoke, but very quickly from that came the beginnings of the mushroom cloud, and as that got a few thousand feet up out of that morass, it changed into every color of the rainbow. I don't believe I ever saw so many colors.
General, you describe yourself as a very religious man, and I'm wondering whether when you saw the impact of the atom bomb, if you felt that man should be capable of such force and such destruction.
Oh, well, you know, the atom bomb, while it had great impact, didn't damage Japan as much as the 5 months of firebombing that had been done there. The loss of life was much, much less than what had occurred during our regular firebombing, which went on day in and day out and day in and day out. And, of course, the book is not a celebration of nuclear weapons. The book is an attempt to record accurate history. the loss of any life devastates me, and I was 25 years old, and I was heartbroken to think of all the American bodies that had been broken and maimed and killed, and for what, you know, for this I believe was the greatest test in our historic knowledge of the forces of good against the forces of evil. Japan had never lost a unit of Japanese forces had never surrendered. Individuals had surrendered, but never a unit. They believed in their old beliefs of Bushido, and suicide is better than death. And in fact, the commander of the Japanese army said that if we conquered them, this would be the greatest mass suicide of all time, because he expected everybody, the millions of people on the home islands, to commit suicide.
It was shortly after you got back from Hiroshima that you were told just a few days later you'd be dropping a newer bomb, a plutonium bomb, over Nagasaki, and you'd be commanding this mission. What was your reaction?
Well, I hoped that the Japanese would quit before that. I didn't relish flying another mission or for the killing that was continuing on both sides in the interim. By the way, President Truman had told them from Potsdam that there would be a rain of ruin from the skies, the like of which mankind has never seen. And yet the warlords would not permit the nation to surrender. My reaction was, if it has to be done, it has to be done. And everything has to be done to end a war, which is an evil war, in which we had no part at all in its initiation.
How are your feelings as a pilot and just as a man affected by having already seen a little bit about what happened in Hiroshima as you were planning for the Nagasaki mission? I mean, this time around you had some sense of what the experience was going to be like for you and what the damage was going to be on the city.
Well, my thoughts were about the execution of the mission. We had a lot of planning to do. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of work to do. Paul Tibbets had told me when he assigned me to the mission that night, the night of the 6th, when we get back from Hiroshima, he told me, of course I knew it, but it was the only bomb we had left. We had the two bombs, and we didn't have any more coming. And first of all, the Japanese warlords thought that they, having survived this, could survive any, or whatever else we did in terms of invasion, and that we only had one, and so forth. This was to prove that we had more, but we only had the one more, and we would have had more later. Now, my hope was that we would not have to do this. In fact, I had a secret recall code word for this mission, which could have been given to me any time prior to the release, if the Japanese had indicated anything at all about a willingness to surrender.
This is a code word that could have even been sent to you as you were in the air with the bomb.
As I was in the air up to the second that it released from my airplane, they could have given me that recall word and I would not have dropped.
You had a fuel problem on the mission to Nagasaki. You had about 600 gallons of fuel that were trapped in such a way that you couldn't use it. This fuel was unusable, and you weren't completely sure you'd have enough fuel to actually fly the mission, and you were less sure you'd have enough fuel to make it back to the base if you did succeed in flying the mission. But you decided to go anyways. Why did you decide to go ahead with it?
Because of what General Tibbets, then Colonel Tibbets, had told me, that the rationale militarily was to show the Japanese, and diplomatically, I suppose, show the Japanese that we had more bombs coming, even though that was the only other bomb that we had. And the weather was forecast to become quite bad after the 9th of August for our purposes. And the 9th was a very important day, and All in all, this seemed to me to be a very, very important mission to execute. And the recovery of the crew was a lot less important than that. But I wasn't sacrificing my crew, but I knew that I'd figure something else out, either landing somewhere or perhaps even in the ocean. And in those days, guys my age who were airplane commanders, I don't think were worried. Well, they were worried, but it's always ticklish to land in the ocean, but it could be done and, you know, be picked up by a ship, hopefully.
Now, on this mission, your secondary target was Nagasaki. The primary target was another city.
Yes, Kokura.
But Kokura was spared. How come the bomb was not dropped on Kokura?
Well, when we got to Kokura, our weather airplane had been there before and told us the proper observed weather, which was early morning haze over the city, and that wasn't too bad. We had orders to drop visually, and we were at 30,000 feet. And when we got there, the city, the first I knew of it, when we bombardier, who had great experience, highly skilled person, Kermit Behan, turned to me very close to the release point, and he said, I can't see it, I can't see it. I looked over his shoulder, and I saw why he couldn't see it. This was a big arsenal in Kokura. And it was now covered by smoke, which had blown over from Yawata, a city that had been firebombed the night before. The wind had shifted and brought that smoke across our aiming point. And I did what is bad practice in the in aerial combat. I went out and made another run. Now, we had flak breaking at our altitude. That's anti-aircraft fire, breaking at our altitude on the way in on the first run. So I changed my altitude from 30,000 to 31,000 feet, hoping it would have some effect on their fusing. But they chased us up to 31,000 feet, and I made another run, and the same thing happened. After the third run, I calculated real fast that we were getting nowhere really, but that I could go to my secondary target, which was Nagasaki. In fact, I was forced to.
When you got to Nagasaki, did you have a clear sight of the target there?
No. Well, we didn't know yet. We're on the radar run. Let's say that we're 50 miles away. Well, we started probably at 100 miles away, and we're approaching the target, and we're on a radar run. And just as we got just short of Nagasaki, very, very short of Nagasaki, said, I've got it, I've got it. And I said in parlance, you own it. And just very few seconds after that, the bomb was released on the Mitsubishi Steel and Arms Works plants on both sides of the river that come into Nagasaki Harbor. And so we made a radar approach, but we made a visual drop.
What was that interim like between the time when the bomb left the plane and the time the bomb detonated, which was, what, about 43 seconds?
Yes. Well, again, we made the turns as quickly as we could, got going in the opposite direction. We saw the flash. The flash was, I thought, subjectively, that the flash was brighter than that at Hiroshima. I can't be sure of that. The concussion that struck the airplane was slightly more forceful, but we knew what it was this time. And so we were extremely short of fuel, and I didn't have any chance to, nor desire to circle back to see the city, although we did get a glimpse of it as we headed for the nearest American held land, which was Okinawa. And we saw much the same thing, the horizontal cloud over the city occasioned by the explosion, and then the mushroom cloud starting up, and again, all the colors, and then the mushroom at the top.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Major General Charles Sweeney, and he flew in the mission over Hiroshima and commanded the mission that dropped the plutonium bomb over Nagasaki. He's written a memoir called War's End. General, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Major General Charles Sweeney. He's written a memoir called War's End about flying the mission over Hiroshima and commanding the mission over Nagasaki during World War II. When did you actually get to Nagasaki and see the damage the bomb created firsthand?
Very, very shortly after the peace was signed on the Missouri, which I think was September 2nd of 1945. And now then we got down to Nagasaki, let's say a couple of days later, so this would have been September 4th. And we were the first ones in there. We were the first Americans in there. That the group of us, we were about 20 men. And we just went to Nagasaki, and we saw the devastation. And the thing that impressed me the most was what had been a fire station was now just a cellar. And in the cellar was a fire engine that looked as if a giant had stepped on it and crushed it into the cellar. And I realized that the whole infrastructure was gone. That is to say, the fire engine couldn't respond, but moreover, if he had responded, there would have been no water pipes to provide water to put out the conflagration. That these are terrible weapons, and I had hoped they wouldn't be used in the first place. I had hoped the Japanese would do the honorable thing and surrender, or call it, describe it however you want it, or quit torturing their own people. Those thoughts were foolish for me to even think that. And we thought, well, gee, the war is over. No more killing. And this was our mission.
Were you aware of radiation sickness before you went to Nagasaki?
No. As a matter of fact, there were some American forces in Nagasaki Harbor restricted to their ships until somebody gave them clearance to go ashore because of the danger of radiation sickness. And we didn't think of that. We just blithely went into Nagasaki, and we found a kind of a resort hotel on the outskirts, and we went in there, and there was a lovely couple running it, and Japanese couple, of course. And I was wondering about signing our proper names on the register, but Colonel Tibbetts stepped right up and did so, and I followed him and did so. And the radiation obviously wasn't there, but we didn't know that it wasn't there or was there. However, some of my men in my organization now joke that we shouldn't have worried about it. One worry was sterility, but I was fortunate enough to have 10 beautiful children. So afterwards, so I guess that wasn't a factor.
A lot of people, I think, who worked on the atom bomb were transformed by it in a very profound way.
No, I don't think that's true.
You don't think that's true?
No, of course not.
I think some of the scientists were.
Well, that may be, and I don't celebrate bombs. I am so much against them. I'm as much against them as anybody in the world. I'm against war, as a matter of fact. This book is neither a history book nor is it a celebration of atomic weapons. It's somewhat to correct some errors that have been made by revisionists. And
I will say here, it's a very interesting account of what happened, what it was like to be there. I think this is information we'd all like to have.
Yes, that's why I wrote the book, and for posterity. I'd like my children and grandchildren and all those, who will come along in future generations to have these have this knowledge. They can draw their own conclusions, but let them have this knowledge. But a lot of these revisionists were brought up they went to school in the 60s, and they were taught that by some professors of however you want to describe them, that the United States is bad, Japanese were victims. The Japanese were victims of their own warlords.
The anniversary dates of the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki are coming up soon. Do you do anything on those days?
Not particularly. We on the 50th, we had a reunion, and we have a reunion coming up this year in Dayton. On the 1st of the 6th, we just renew acquaintances, as anybody does at any reunion.
Have you ever, ever had a moment of doubt about the atom bombs dropped over Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
Well, now, Terry, having told you what I've told you so far, I don't see how you can possibly even think that I might have. I mean, I've told you that I don't celebrate any nuclear weapon. These nuclear weapons or any others. And I've never had a doubt that we were fighting evil, 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 the Hitlers and the Tojos and the Mussolinis.
So, to sum up, never, ever a doubt.
Never a doubt. I mean, why should I doubt? I am joyous about the 500,000 Americans that weren't killed or wounded, or 400,000, 300,000, 200,000, 100,000, whatever it was. There was no need for those thousands of Americans who lie under white crosses out there to be dead.
Major General Charles Sweeney has a new memoir called War's End. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.